Impact of Influence, The Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth.
Hello, friend. So grateful that you're going to spend some time with us today. I am Matt Harris. Seton Tucker is on vacation, and our legal analyst, former prosecutor, and former defense attorney, John Snyder, is with us in studio. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hello, hello, hello. If you want to reach out to us all, you can do it. Just get to murdochpodcast.com or Murdoch Podcast on Facebook. We'll always love to hear what you have to say and your thoughts. It also goes directly to me, mattharrispodcast@gmail.com. Lots of Russell Lafitte stuff to talk about today. A lot of things cranking up with the Lafitte issue, and maybe some more names are going to fall. It's a new lawsuit naming other attorneys that's all tied to this, and we will get to it all, but we have to start out with what is happening as we sit down here to record this podcast is that a trial date has been set for Alec Murdoch. The double murder trial will begin January 30th in Collin County before Judge Clifton Newman. And Clifton Newman has been overseeing a lot of the Murdoch things that have happened over the last year and more. And they say he's a no-nonsense kind of judge. And the trial is expected to last about 3 weeks. All right, John Snyder, first off, both sides have wanted it to be a speedy trial. They thought before December, but that was really unlikely. So January 30th seems like a reasonable date that we would have guessed.
I think it's reasonable. It is still quick. But it feels quick only because it's quick from indictment to trial date. They took a whole year of investigation. So in that regard, it's really been almost a year and a half to come from the date of the crime all the way to a trial. That's well done work by the state.
So many times the indictment to trial will be longer?
Much longer. In a first-degree murder case or a capital murder case, it can take years. And so this is rather quick. The defense will say it speaks to the lack of the state's case, and so they're just trying to go ahead with it. The state will, and I think that's probably more accurate, will say that's the strength of our evidence is so clear and convincing and beyond a reasonable doubt, we're ready to go.
So they feel by the span of time between the indictment and the trial would lead you to believe that the state doesn't feel like they need a lot of investigation to be done now. They feel like they've got most of their case.
I think, it feels like in this particular case, they did all the work up front pre-indictment. And so now they've got everything they need to move forward and they're not objecting to this trial date. They're not that, we haven't heard anything about a motion to continue. They're ready to go. So what'll be interesting now is to see whether the defense really is ready to go.
Because they could have been playing a PR game, and now they say all of a sudden, you know what? That's pretty fast. We just got these things. We just got this. That'll be the story if they need that.
Yes. Cases only get better for defendants over time.
Right.
So, witnesses die, evidence gets lost, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
A quick case like this, I would argue, speaks to the weight of the evidence that the state has in favor of a conviction.
Also, I saw that there's 3 weeks marked out. I didn't know that when a trial started, the circuit or whoever tries to decide how long it's going to be.
You talked to both sides. Yes, defense counsel, how long they think their evidence will take. Yes, the state, how long you think their evidence will take. Jury selection in this case, my guess will be at least a week. You're going to have to cull through a lot of people from Colleton County that don't have knowledge or relationship. And so that jury selection may be the longest part of this jury trial.
Do you think the trial will be televised?
I think the trial should be televised based on the nature of the parties involved. Mm-hmm. I think it's in the public's interest that it should be, but that is 100% discretionary to the judge.
This popped in my mind just now. The fact that it went from indictment to trial relatively quickly. Other times you say there's a long, long, long delay. Is sometimes the fact that the indictment happens and there's delay because the state just wants whoever it is off the street. And in this case, they didn't necessarily have to rush for Ehrlich's indictment because he was already behind bars and wasn't going anywhere. Does that come into play with how quickly they do an indictment?
I think because of his profession, because of the position he had locally, I think the state was a little more circumspect in pulling the trigger on the indictment till they had all their evidence lined up.
So they could wait the little over a year since the crime, and we don't even know if it was day one that they were putting a case together.
That's right. And so meanwhile, in other murder cases, you can arrest on probable cause and go mm-hmm. through that. I think they did not want to have any air in their case between accusation and evidence.
And it gave them a little leeway with the fact that he was behind bars.
They knew where he was. He wasn't going anywhere.
Because if he hadn't been on behind bars for all the gazillion charges, 90 charges, $8.8 million in stealing money, people might have said, why did you let him walk around all this time when you thought he murdered his wife and kid?
That's exactly right. If the only crime that he was accused of was the murder, they would have arrested him sooner.
Because it would have looked bad.
Public safety.
I mean, public safety,
yeah,
too,
I mean,
right.
And that's what they do in every other murder case.
Okay.
Here, he was already in custody. He was already being investigated criminally for other matters. And bond was set at an appropriate amount after a lot of litigation. So it made sense.
So now let's move to the latest Ehrlich Murdoch lawsuit, where two more Hampton attorneys have been named. I don't think anybody is surprised that more names will be coming up as this continues. Russell Lafitte, of course, is being charged federally, which Ehrlich is not as of yet. And this latest civil suit now engulfs these attorneys at Peters, Murdoch, Parker, Ellsroth, and Dietrich, which was PMPED, but that name is no longer, and Michael DeWitt in the Greenville News wrote a really great article about it. The lawsuit was filed October 7th on behalf of Manuel Santiz Cristiani. He's a citizen and resident of Mexico and a former client of Murdoch. And again, it was one of those deals where there was settlement, it alleges. The settlement never got to the person who should receive it. That's the crux of the lawsuit. John Snyder, you've looked at the paperwork. What does it say? What's going on here?
So basically, you've nailed the allegations. This guy was driving down I-95. His tire blew out, and there were some serious injuries as a result of the blowout and the car wreck and all that.
I want to mention that was in 2008.
Okay. 2008. So in 2013, a settlement was reached between the plaintiff and the defendant, which included an automobile manufacturer, a tire manufacturer, and whoever else was named in the lawsuit. What happened next is they settled, and apparently there was a payout to the plaintiff. And now in 2022, the plaintiff is saying, I had no idea. I didn't authorize the settlement. I wasn't aware of the dismissal, and I certainly wasn't aware of the money being paid. And so they've asked for an accounting. They want to know what came in, when, and where it went.
Mm-hmm.
They've asked for, they've accused the law firm and others of basically fraud, mm-hmm. Conversion, which is taking something that belongs to another person and converting it to your own use. And they have taken they've named the lawyers that were on the case, mm-hmm. as well as the law firm, alleging negligent supervision.
And they deposited the funds in Palmetto State Bank, where Russell Lafitte served as conservator of the funds.
Right.
So he's up again in this thing.
So, and just as we've said a long time ago, these cases are just going to keep rolling in.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that ever had that law firm represent them in a personal injury case or a civil case is going to either bring a lawsuit, and if they don't, they should absolutely check the records to make sure that the numbers add up.
Murdoch, of course, is named, and Crosby and Barnes are the other two attorneys named. And Crosby is saying, he's coming out swinging, saying, this is ridiculous. His name's Ronnie Crosby. He's a partner and shareholder at the former PMPD. William Barnes III, a former attorney at the former PMPED. And both of them are saying this is a bunch of garbage. Barnes says, I was aware of this lawsuit. Any allegation of wrongdoing on my part is false. The trust of this community is something I've worked hard to earn during my career as a lawyer and intend to defend my reputation. Crosby said any allegation in the lawsuit that it's anything improper or false, and the plaintiff and his attorneys know any such claim is false. I call upon them to immediately dismiss me from this lawsuit. And the attorneys are Orangeburg attorneys. And I would imagine, as you said, more and more of these are going to be rolling out. There are attorneys, I would imagine, searching through every nook and cranny, every civil case, anything that went through that law firm, right?
Absolutely. And for just cause. And,
yes.
And the other two attorneys that are named in the lawsuit that aren't Alex, they may have been associates at the time. They may have just been doing their job as baby lawyers in filing a lawsuit.
So it is possible that if there's three names on some sort of civil lawsuit or a settlement, two of those people might have been doing paperwork or might have been filing things. Like, they aren't completely aware. They're not in the settlement part of it.
They're not.
It's possible.
They're not as they say in Hamilton, they're not in the room, right? They are drafting things, handing it to their boss, who mm-hmm. would have been Alec, and then he is going to negotiate things. So their name's on there because they are appearing in the case. And that doesn't take them off the hook necessarily. But like, let's say the settlement was reached after Barnes left the law firm. Just because his name was on a pleading doesn't mean he had anything to do with the conversion or the dismissing a case without the knowledge of the plaintiff.
So the injury was in 08, and then PMPED attorneys filed the products liability suit on 2011, and then 2013 the attorneys negotiated a settlement. Now, when they say the attorneys negotiated a settlement, you're saying it's possible that the other two guys weren't part of the negotiation.
That's right. Their names appear on the pleading. Right. So giving those guys the benefit of the doubt, their name appeared on the pleadings, but that may have been as much as their involvement might be. And that would be typical in a law firm where the young lawyers draft things, their name goes on, they might get to come to court with their boss, they might get to argue a motion.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the senior work's done by the senior lawyer.
And if you were going to rip somebody off allegedly, you might want to pick some guy who lives in Mexico and easily could be unaware of settlements, or it just kind of goes away in his head. He's doing whatever he's doing.
Alex is saying, we're seeing a trend of victims who are either, they suffer from a medical condition, they suffer from a mental condition, or they're non-residents in the area.
Easier ones to fly under the radar and solve and settle and then put in the bank. And so if this is true that there was a settlement and Lafitte is the, what do they call it, the conservator, he has a responsibility to hunt down the person the money's for, right?
He does. And you would try to do everything to contact them. And then in the event you couldn't find them, eventually you would turn the money over to the state and it would go into a sheets. Like there's a process for this to be handled that was not followed in this case.
Right.
And it's similar to, like, very early on, we talked about the trooper who was in
Trooper Moore. Yeah.
He was represented by the firm and now has turned around and sued.
Yeah. Where's my money, man? So this will go to civil for now. It's a crime, right? Or I mean,
oh yeah. I mean, yeah. It's and crimes are alleged through the civil conspiracy claim that's in there. And ultimately law enforcement will look at that and be like, okay, well, here's
another, you know, one.
Here's indictment 598.
And listen, I'm not saying that there's not a lot of people who are involved with this and there's not a lot of potential corruption there, but I also talked to an attorney from our area we live, but knows a bunch of people down there, and they're all kind of worried that they will get pulled into this, even though they didn't do anything nefarious, or you're just by association, like it's potentially, like you said, these guys might not have known about that. So there's a lot of people whose names could be dragged around here in the next few months, years.
Well, if they associated that firm on a lawsuit, so let's say that you live in Fort Mill and you're driving down to Fripp Island and you're in an automobile accident.
Mm-hmm.
You may ask your buddy that does your other legal work in Fort Mill to represent you. Well, mm-hmm. a smart attorney is going to find local counsel. And so there's all those cases.
Oh, I got
where people associated their law firm. You got to remember, prior to the fall, he was the head of the Trial Lawyers Association. So
Alec was.
So he handled cases for all kinds of attorneys.
Wow.
Especially if there was any jurisdictional opportunity for him down in the low country. And so it is a valid concern for those other lawyers to be like, oh dear Lord, I hope that our accounting matches up and that what was actually settled was paid,
because his reputation at that point, he said the head of the trial, it was good.
Sterling. Yeah, Sterling. I mean, if you got in an accident down that way, one of your clients did, or a referral did, that's who you would call.
I see.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Let's move to sort of move. It's all kind of involved in the same thing, but Russell Lafitte and his attorneys have said, by the way,
take a little break and get you ready for some traveling you've got coming up, some international trip where you want to be able to at least get around, right? So you want to learn the language of the country that you're going to. You want to experience it with a little bit of knowledge going in. And you can get a lot of bit of knowledge when you use Rosetta Stone. It's the most trusted language learning program. It's available on desktop. It can also be used as an app on your phone or tablet. And Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion. It's instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals. You read stories, you participate in dialogues, so you are ready to go. It's the most trusted, time-tested app out there. They've been the expert in language learning for 30 years. Buy Rosetta Stone now, and you never have to pay a renewal fee. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Impact of Influence listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 40% off. That's 40% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 40% off at rosettastone.com/today.
He's the accomplice. Michael DeWitt, another great story about this. He's the accomplice of Alec Murdoch, but he has these federal charges. And so there's all these pretrial motions in state and federal courts. to dismiss criminal charges, a motion to give Lafitte's wife half of his frozen assets is what I want to figure out what's going on. That doesn't seem like something someone charged with a crime can do, but explain to me what's happening here.
So obviously the wife had a particular standard of living that now being under house arrest can't be met. And a number of their things are frozen and are under the control of the courts. And so the wife may be saying, hey, I didn't have anything to do with this. The amount that's frozen doesn't come anywhere near the amount that's alleged to have been converted or taken by Lafitte. And so she wants to get her portion out of the of being frozen.
Okay, because like they sold their family home in Varnville, netting $317,000 for the legal trust account. And so she doesn't want, she's not motion, not making a motion to get all of it. Right, she's making a motion to get, I believe, a little more than half of some of these purchases and sales they've had. So it's not the whole thing.
It's not the whole thing, and it may be that these are the fruits of her own labor, and because she happened to put them in a bank account with Russell, she can't access them anymore.
Well, like in the house sale, her name was on it, and his name was on it.
Right.
So they're saying that 50% should be
released to her. That's exactly right.
Okay. Now, how do you think that will play out?
I think if the source of funds, so the court will go back and look at, well, how did you all pay for this? Okay. Did you pay for it? You know, was a down payment come from your savings account and you put $10,000 down and you got a mortgage, that kind of thing? Or did, you know, was there suddenly $300,000 deposited into your bank account? And as a result of that $300,000, you bought the house.
Okay. So I think that people may have seen the headline. They talk, word spreads that he's going to give his assets, like all his assets, but it's the house sale mainly that they're talking about. And the counter motion says that the law says that the uninvolved spouse should not receive a windfall at the expense of the victim where community assets were acquired with funds that were stolen from the victim. So that's what they're going to hunt down, right? Did you buy this with stolen funds?
Yeah. I mean, so the ultimate contention is she's coming in to say this thing here or this half of what's out there has nothing to do with the funny business that my husband's accused of being involved in.
Now, what the AG's office, I believe, is saying is we shouldn't decide any of this stuff till we do the whole Lafitte trial. That's their thought.
That's right. Again, understandable on both sides.
Where the
state says, hey, we have a victim. The purpose of the criminal justice system is to make people whole. And so if we can't, if you take money out and it turns out that the money you took out was needed to make people whole, you shouldn't have that money.
Right. All right. And by the way, Lafitte's out on $1 million bond. Location monitoring restricts him to Hampton and Allendale counties, unless you go to court in Charleston or wherever that may be. Now, let's move to Will's story in Fitz News about possibly being some tapes out there that Russ Lafitte made, and there was an emergency hearing on it on October 6th, and we'll never know what was in that hearing, I'm sure, John. That's a closed kind of deal, right? But the hearing is allegedly about this tape or evidence requested by Trenum Walker, an attorney who represents Palmetto State Bank. And that's where, of course, Lafitte was and the family business sort of was. And there might be a tape or some sort of evidence, but they're saying audio recording, in which multiple PSB leaders, this is from the Fitz News story, are rumored to be implicated. It's some of the criminal conduct of which Lafitte stands accused. And if that's the case, Palmetto State Bank is going to do everything they can to make sure that tape doesn't see the light of day, correct? And let's say it does exist, what would be their pitch that this shouldn't see light?
So What it'll be is it could be minutes. A board meeting was recorded by Lafitte, and in it, he says, hey, we have this line of credit outstanding for Murdoch. Do you guys want to call it due? And they took a vote, and they all said, no, he's, you know, we like him. We like his dad. We liked his granddad. So let's just let this one ride. Well, all of a sudden now, it's not Lafitte who's engaged in this criminal conspiracy. It's just poor banking management. And so that is why both Palmetto would prefer it not to get out, because then the bank's on the hook for these issues. It may be more a clearer record of what the bank did or didn't know, and that it wasn't that Lafitte was actually doing what the board directed him to do, as opposed to him being engaged in nefarious dealings.
But they, would they have a leg to stand on? Is there some sort of privacy thing that I wouldn't think, right? Unless there's an attorney. Could there be an attorney in the room? And they're like, no, we were just talking with our attorney.
I think it would be disclosed. And then obviously, I think if, you know, once you get in the habit of recording things, he's probably recording the conversation he has with Alec. He's recording conversations he has had with other people to be like, well, I'm not sure how this is going, but I'm going to make sure that I have a record on my way out.
I mean, it would indicate a idea of what he was doing was wrong if he's recording things and he doesn't normally record them, right? I mean, that would, why else you record? You don't normally record it. Now you start recording things and you keep it. To me, that says, well, I knew something was fishy.
Not unless you are, let's say you work at the bank and the board is starting to ask you to do things. You're like, I'm not sure about that. And the board's like, no, you go ahead and do it. Yeah. We authorize you to do it.
That's what I mean. You would only record it if you think, let's assume he doesn't record every single one in the history. You only record it if you think you might need this.
That's exactly right. It's an act of self-preservation. And so the question is, what was going on that made him think he needed self-preservation?
And in the Will article, Will Fox article, it says, Lafitte knows that someone who is dropping dimes on him is guilty of conduct every bit as bad as what he has been accused of doing, perhaps worse. Sure, that the deposition was taken in February 2022, and he did make comments about other people that worked there and whatnot, and he's working with the feds right now, and a lot of the decisions Russell Lafitte made might have had to get approval. Right, it would. It's possible that somebody signed off on giving Alec money, or at a certain rate.
Russell's not the only person at the bank who knew that money was either owed or being spent in a manner that wasn't consistent with how you or I would get money at a bank.
It's very possible that business had been done that way for 50 years or whatever. It's like the PMPD, that's like Murdoch, they're the Murdochs. We give them this rate because we know they're good with it. We're a small bank. We need
the deposits.
We need the deposits.
Right.
And would it go something like this? Could Alec say, hey, I need $100,000, but you know me, I always got another settlement coming down the pipe. So just, you know how long those things take. Just give me $100,000. Could that be like a conversation?
That would be exactly the conversation. And if they are holding the funds in a trust fund, they're sitting anytime on maybe $20 million plus.
Mm.
And so loaning out $100,000 when their deposit rate for a small bank is so high, it makes sense. And it could be, hey, this is how you loan money to my granddad. This is how you loan money to my dad. I'm Alec. I'm number three. You should loan money to me in the same way.
And now when we're having this discussion, I want to point out, that doesn't mean we think that's okay. I'm just saying this is how the game played. It may be played around. I probably played around the country like that.
It was the cut. It definitely should not be.
Yes, it should not be.
Yeah. The FDIC is pretty particular about how money goes out. They're also really particular about lending practices being uniform so that, one group isn't being treated differently than another.
You shouldn't get a
group.
Different rate based on your last name. That kind of
That's
thing.
That's right.
I mean, your credit score, you get a different rate maybe, correct. But not, I'm a Murdoch.
You get special treatment based on objective criteria, not on who you are.
Right. And it also becomes clear as we start seeing more and more of these cases come up that this has possibly been going on for certainly 15 years at the minimum with Alec. One of the cases settled was like 08 or something like that. So it's been on a long time. You'd think a responsible bank might start to go like, what's the deal in this? There's like things coming in and out.
Well, in a conservatorship for a 16-year-old, $200,000 goes out. That should immediately ring a bell to be like, okay, on these accounts, it should be for living expense. Mm-hmm. So what living expense does a 16-year-old have that would require $200,000? And so that would be the kind of thing a smaller bank, they might have a meeting to say, okay, out of this conservatorship, the conservator has asked for money to buy a house. Okay, well then that expenditure makes sense. But not having any check or balance on that could be the fault of the bank.
PMPD with Alec Murdoch and Russell Lafitte at the bank, there's one of two things going on each case. Either very, very poor checks and balances
mm-hmm.
that people are just, or, well, I guess there's three things. One, very, very poor checks and balances. Two, people just look the other way and like, I don't even, let's, you know, I know there's some things, but it's not that bad. Or three, a total and 100% acknowledgement and knowledge of what was going on. Those are the kind of the three things.
That's right. And then if they had actual knowledge, what were they receiving a benefit? Were there side payments? Were other officers of the bank doing business with Alec that made them want to approve his loans?
Like, oh, cool. Yeah. Right.
I mean, there's just
The tentacles.
And again, what this case has proven is, who knows?
Right.
Like we still have yet to reach the bottom, because now we're seeing lawsuits about people that are visiting our country getting ripped off.
Right.
So
right.
Like, what wouldn't they do along the way?
I don't even know if you know the answer to this, but how hard is it to comb through every PMPD, every Alec Murdoch civil suit or criminal case? How hard is that to comb through?
It depends on the number, but it's very possible. And we haven't even begun to get to any of the criminal
right.
cases that were brought and prosecuted by Alec.
That's a great point.
If I was in prison in South Carolina because he was the prosecutor,
mm-hmm.
I would be filing a motion for appropriate relief to revisit my case, because the prosecutor may have not been the most scrupulous one dealing in this case.
Well, and you also have, if you're the person who was sent to jail by Alec, you might have been sent to jail by what they claim to be an addict.
Right.
Or I think he defended some people. I know he defended some people too.
Right.
So if he lost those cases,
then you got a motion for ineffective assistance of counsel claim. I mean, it's just any case file that he ever touched is open to examination and the potential for a lawsuit.
How long do you think it would take? For people who were prosecuted by him, say, why haven't we heard anything about that? Is that a really strenuous case? Does an attorney have to do it? Can the guy in prison do it?
You would need to file a motion, and it may be that even though he was an honorary or an auxiliary
right.
prosecutor, so he may have only sat in traffic court
right.
once a month. And, you know, and he might have been culling the traffic court stuff for automobile accidents. So he's there,
gotcha.
You know, he's there getting an update on potential people to reach out to represent in personal injury cases.
So, yes, as the, you know, volunteer prosecutor plus his dad granddad or whatever. You're right. They get knowledge of accidents pretty quickly.
Correct.
And so that flyer's in the mailbox. Plus, they know everybody in the area.
And they can reach out directly and say, I've actually already talked to the person that hit you. They're willing to agree, you know, they're willing to instruct their insurance company to pay you policy limits.
Gosh, this thing is insane. The amount of I keep saying tentacles that go out, and the number of attorneys who right now are like combing through settlements, people who are in jail. It's going to be a lot.
Well, you've got all the billboard lawyers, and then you've got everybody is out looking to figure out where a big payoff is. And the insurance company for this law firm has got to just be, you know,
freaking out.
How do they gauge what their losses are going to be based on this guy's behavior? And at what point do they stop doing payouts to all these clients?
Yeah.
Of the firm?
At one point, they might just go, I'm broke. I got nothing.
Yeah.
What? I don't even know this is a thing. Do the companies that paid out, I don't know, State Farm Insurance or somebody, do they have any care to even go find out any of this stuff? Or are they going to be involved ever? An insurance company? Like, wait a minute.
None of the insurance companies are going to be parties to fraudulent payouts. I mean, that's...
No, they're not part of it, but I'm saying they're going to start digging into it.
I think the insurer of the lawyers and the law firm are absolutely...
They are
tracing cases as we speak, for sure, to be like, okay, they've reached out to State Farm to say, okay, in all the automobile claims that you guys had, how many of them in Culleton County were paid to this law firm?
Okay, so they're going to get ahead of it. It's not the law firm doing it. It is the law firm's insurance company doing it.
It's everybody. Everybody is trying to figure out what the bottom is, and we have not reached it yet, in my opinion.
All right. And so they want to know where the bottom is because that can make their plan. They don't want surprises at this point.
They don't want surprises. That's exactly right. And right now, all we get are surprises.
Correct. Cool having you in studio, John.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
That was very cool. You reach out to us, Murdoch Podcast, Facebook, murdochpodcast.com. And Matt Harris Podcast at gmail.com. Seton will be back next week. And as always, so grateful that you were hanging with us.
Join Hala Taha for actionable advice from the brightest minds in the world on the Young and Profiting Podcast. Author and academic Arthur Brooks on what success isn't.
The husband was confessing to his wife that he might as well be dead. And I'm thinking, whoa, what's wrong with this guy? I turn around to get a look, and it turns out to be one of the most famous men in the world. The world tells you that if you are profiting, money, power, pleasure, fame, you're going to be happy. And that's a bogus formula.
The Young and Profiting Podcast, wherever you listen.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderick.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth. And together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.